But today we're not talking about ethics. Instead, the legal history of what was, for a long time, simply referred to as an illegal operation. In his latest book, The Racket, writer Gideon Hay examines the legal history of abortion and how the lack of laws led to a flourishing, often corrupted trade over many years. And he's been left wondering how an issue with the potential to affect so many Australians has actually received so little legislative attention over the years. Gideon Hay joins me now. Welcome back to Life Matters, Gideon.
Oh, nice to be back, Richard.
Before we start, let's clarify, if we can, the legal situation regarding abortion in Australia. What's the story?
I'd love to be able to put that succinctly, but in Australia we've had basically 40 years of piecemeal measures which have ensured the availability within certain legal requirements of abortion in all states. In some states, it's protected by legislation. In Victoria, New South Wales, and Queensland, however, it's entirely preserved by the common law. And in the Victorian case, a ruling called the Menhennitt ruling in 1969 in the Victorian Supreme Court, which enshrined an idea that had been first espoused in England in an earlier case called the Bourne case, that abortion was permissible where continuation of the pregnancy would have a significant deleterious effect on the woman's physical or mental health. It's one of the reasons why we're at the moment having the debate in Victoria about the Abortion Law Reform Bill. We're finally revisiting this common law ruling 40 years after it was made.
Yeah, there's sort of three options on the table in Victoria, aren't there?
That's right. And a bill has been introduced to Parliament which will decriminalise abortion in the first 24 weeks of gestation. It surprises people that that abortion is still a criminal act in Victoria. It's still part of the Crimes Act. I think the perception among most people is that, abortion, wasn't that taken care of years ago?
Yeah, exactly. I think you touched on this, but only the ACT, am I right in thinking that's the only jurisdiction in the country where it is legally available on demand?
That's right. They talk about abortion on demand, even though I actually find that a kind of an unsatisfactory formulation. I think the idea of abortion on demand sort of summons up the idea of a woman marching into a clinic and banging her hand on the desk and saying, "I demand my abortion." I don't think anyone does that.
No.
I think that it kind of travestises the issue to use that expression.
Perhaps the wrong terminology. Mm. Well, from the earliest times, most abortions were self-administered, apart from often dying as a result or being terribly butchered. How were the women themselves and those caring for them as well, how were they treated by the law?
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating. Abortion in Australia, its availability certainly goes through perceptibly different periods. As you say, up until about the Second World War, it was the era of the midwife who sort of viewed abortion as part of the genuine continuum of reproductive health care. The amateur enthusiast, the colloquially known as the backyard abortionist, and abortifacients, which are which not just substances but also activities with abortifacient qualities. So there'd be things like pennyroyal, aloes, myrrh, ergo of rye, castor oil, baking soda. Things like eating matches or drinking turpentine. There was folklore that if you boiled copper coils in a liquor, then if you drank that, it would induce contractions. There were even ideas that riding bicycles or jumping off high places or driving on bumpy roads or even travelling on the Big Dipper at Luna Park would somehow induce or precipitate contractions and allow a fetus to be aborted. One of the most popular methods was what was called elm bark, which in a lot of Australian households was just kept in a jar on the mantelpiece and inserted in the cervix. And as it swelled from the moisture surrounding it, it precipitated contractions. And, of course, it was hardly a sterile instrument.
No.
And it often exposed women to incredible health risks.
Well, I mean, you're writing on the Big Dipper is one and some of the things you describe are kind of unintentionally hilarious. But women also did themselves tremendous damage. I mean, you're talking about tremendous rates of infection, hospitals actually having to get bigger in a way to cope with it.
That's right. And that was because we were in the pre antibiotic era, when basically any kind of intrusion into the body, unsupervised, and was a potential risk of septicemia. And in the 1930s, when Australia's birth rate really plunged, it's the lowest birth rate since, or the lowest reproductive rate since colonisation, you had entire wings of hospitals given over to taking septicemia patients who had self-induced abortion using either sharp instruments or using another instrument. Some listeners out there might remember it, called the Higginson syringe, which was a novel rubber reservoir and a pump devised for enemas and douches in the 1850s. But it was also widely rumoured that if you inserted Lysol, which was a disinfectant, or a solution involving Lifebuoy, which was a soap, you could induce a miscarriage.
It's horrific, isn't it? I mean, it's just appalling.
It's horrific, but it's astounding how stoically women withstood that prohibition. You know, it was just something that had to be done, and God knows they went ahead and did it. It was surprising to me to write this story, because I sort of, it's not very often written about. It's the kind of history that doesn't necessarily automatically record itself. It's not something on which detailed statistics are kept. It's not something that people are particularly enthusiastic about talking about. It's no. Usually a procedure over which people want to get as quickly as possible. So I did genuinely feel in writing this book that I was writing a kind of a secret history, entering into a kind of walled off chamber. And I think the book is also not just about abortion, but it's about prohibition, in a sense that, you know, when you prohibit a sought after procedure, you inevitably seem to expose people to greater dangers and to criminal odium and to social disapprobation and legal intimidation, which just adds a whole layer of awfulness to something that's already quite awful.
Well, I want to actually talk about the fact that it was criminal and it was illicit, and so it was illegal in a moment. We're talking today with Gideon Haigh, who the writer and journalist, whose latest book, The Racket, really details the kind of legal history of abortion and what people did before it was legally possible to obtain one. You mentioned the Menhennitt ruling, but I want to talk to you about the situation kind of before that, because you write that police efforts to curtail abortion were mainly pointless and thankless, an outcome to a large extent of the law. By then, there was a lot of corruption, wasn't there?
Well, it certainly, it was almost an unenforceable law, because everyone knew that if you were determined to obtain an abortion, you would be able to obtain one, you know, whether you're running a criminal gauntlet or not. And I think juries seem to instinctively understand that when abortionists and patients were put on trial, juries shrank from potentially restricting abortions' availability for a couple of reasons. One, because God knows you might need one of them one day yourself. But they also quailed at their discretion, because abortionists seldom came before the courts on the charge simply of procuring a miscarriage. Usually a death was involved. They were potentially exposed to a capital offence, and juries did distinguish between someone who had died as the result of or killed as the result of trying to induce an abortion, and someone who had killed in cold blood.
But awful as it was for the women and their families, there were vested interests who wanted to keep abortion dark and illegal.
Well, I think certainly after the Second World War, when antibiotics radically improved the quality of the procedure and the safety of the procedure, doctors moved in and tended to eclipse the midwives and the backyarders. And I think, thanks to a mixture of conservatism and self-interest, doctors did quite a lot to keep abortion illegal for as long as it was. I mean, in many respects, it suited doctors, both the providers and the GPs to whom they paid kickbacks for referrals, because fee scales for abortion were open-ended. There was no tax to pay. cash tendered furtively in brown envelopes was not the kind of thing that attracted the taxation department. There were no standards to observe. There was no need for consumer protection. It actually became, as I point out in the title, a very lucrative racket.
You just have to pay off a few policemen, polls
suggested that there was sort of widespread public support for liberalisation of abortion laws into the 1960s. There was actually relatively little appetite for civil disobedience of the kind, say, incited by Ronald Ryan's execution. And, you know, if you needed an abortion, there was always somebody in your circle who knew somebody who had a friend who knew about those things.
Now, of course, one name that is synonymous with this cause, and certainly he's been mentioned on this show before, is Dr. Bertram Wainer. And you're right, he seemed to be searching for a cause worth the candle, and he was determined to reveal the police corruption which had nurtured the illegality of abortions. How do you sum up his legacy?
Yeah, look, it's fascinating. I think, you know, from my perception as a lay reader, I'd always assumed that the story was somehow that in the dark old days abortion was illegal. Then came Bertram Wainer, and you know, light radiated from the 60s counterculture, and all was good. It was actually a lot more complicated than that. I'll go back slightly. As I said, in practice, the law was actually seldom applied, and what actually happened was that in the mid 1960s, an ambitious Catholic chief of homicide in Victoria, a man called Frank Holland, decided that he was going to try and make abortion law relevant again by arresting doctors and systematically coercing their terrified patients into testifying against those doctors. Well, the law of unintended consequences took a hand. A doctor was prosecuted called Dr. Kenneth Davidson in 1969, and in the course of it, Justice Clifford Menhennett, in the course of the case involving Davidson, Clifford Menhennett gave a ruling along the lines that I mentioned before, that abortion was lawful where it was necessary to preserve the woman from a serious danger to her life or her physical or mental health. Now, the evidence was actually, this ruling was intended mainly as a clarification for jurors, and it probably didn't bear materially on Davidson's eventual acquittal. But what happened was that Wainer, who had already become interested in the issue, decided to take the Menhennett ruling and to see whether it actually stood up. And about 4 weeks later, he theatrically turned himself in to homicide, having taken responsibility for an abortion. He actually hadn't done the abortion. Another doctor had actually performed it on his behalf. And he said, OK, well, a judge has given this ruling. Let's see whether it actually stands up to scrutiny. And if it does, I won't be prosecuted. And he wasn't. In a sense, he sort of drew, by his actions, he drew attempt to the fact that this ruling had been made, which had actually rather surprisingly passed without notice. There was no reporter in the court on the day that the ruling was given. You know, you go back to the papers at the time, and on the Age front page, the most important feminist issue of the day in question was, "Are women who wear pants respectable?"
Gideon, it is a remarkable story, and you've really documented it well. But what surprises me is some of the figures you quote. 2 in 3 Australian pregnancies are unplanned. 1 in 3 Australian women will have an abortion in their lifetime. That seems extraordinarily high, and given that, so little legislative energy over the years.
Well, yeah, abortion is a raw subject. I mean, it turns what society celebrates as life's most fulfilling experience into a shaming experience. It involves intensely personal questions as well as, you know, grand ethical dilemmas. I'm not surprised in a sense that certainly politicians have tended to steer clear of it. And one of the reasons why we got a common law ruling in Victoria was not because there was any great pro-life movement at the time that was standing in the way of further liberalisation, but it was a fact that the Bolte government relied on, for its continuance, on the preferences of the Democratic Labour Party, which was of course the
Catholics.
Catholic anti-communist wing of the old Labour Party, and they shrank from any gesture that might jeopardise that entente cordiale, it's funny, you know, you look back and you find that where abortion was concerned in Australia in the 1960s, there was actually very little debate, at least as we would understand it. It was considered really a sort of a minor civil liberties matter rather than a significant feminist cause.
That's where we'll leave it, Gideon. Thank you very much for joining
us. My pleasure, Richard.
That's Gideon Hay, and his latest book, The Racket, is published by Melbourne University Press. One of our most thoughtful journalists, I think Gideon is. Now, coming up on Life Matters, unless you are a vegan, you eat some form of animal products. Are you changing your habits in the interest of animal welfare?
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.